Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 391, side 2, titled Discussion Points of September 11th and Related Topics. This has been recorded on December 15th of 2002, and once again at the outset I will apologize because I have a little bit of a head cold, so if my verbal skills or vocal skills would be a better way of putting it are somewhat attenuated, that's why. Let me also remind you that there are detailed annotated descriptions of the For the Record programs in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, so if it's easier for you to read than to listen, you've got plenty to read. They're available at spitfirelist.com in the For the Record section, and they are for free. There are also long taped programs and lectures that are available from Spitfire for a nominal fee. I do not get money from those. Those also have descriptions. And thanks to sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, for all intents and purposes, the entire For the Record series is available online on Real Audio for free. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older For the Record programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website as well. And again, a big salute, a big tip of the hat to WFMU for taking the lead in archiving the whole For the Record series online for free. Now, as I indicated at the beginning of the broadcast, due to the enormous volume of material and the complexity, the conceptual complexity of the paths of inquiry that I've indulged in or engaged in connection with September 11th, I thought it would be useful, and some other people with whom I've consulted agreed, to take a program, and this is what I'm doing now, and basically review and present some of the major points of conceptualization of this not only massive but very important, consummately important and ongoing path of inquiry. Now, in the first side, we took a look at some of the corridors of financial power connecting the world of Islamo-fascism to domestic American fascists, the Bormann Organization, the Bush family, and to the world of Euro-fascism, Italian fascism in particular, and to the world of Islamo-fascism. Not that Islam is fascist, but there is a powerful fascist element within Islam that uses Islam as a cover for political fascism. This Islamo-fascism has been aligned with Euro-fascism and the Underground Reich from the period between the two world wars on up through the present time. Now, again, the entire landmass going from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, the former Soviet Union, the Middle East, China, India, Pakistan, that is one giant landmass containing most of the world's landmass, most of its population, and most importantly, most of its oil reserves. The Nazi geopoliticians called that the Earth Island. Across the middle of that huge stretch of territory and population and natural resources is a large Muslim population. The Third Reich and the Axis saw control of that Muslim population and the consequent control of the Earth Island as the key to world domination. At the conclusion of Side 1, we were talking about the Muslim Brotherhood, inextricably linked to the Al-Taqwa Nexus and to Al-Qaeda, and also targeted by the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th. One of the most important people looming in the background of Islamo-fascism and Euro-fascism and to the Axis's attempts at controlling the Earth Island was a guy named Haj Amin al-Husseini, who called himself the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He was a Muslim mufti, a Muslim prelate, and he also was a major in the SS and a key Axis spy. He also was the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement. Among the things that we've looked at in connection with Haj Amin al-Husseini, and we've discussed him and among other For the Record programs, 330, 332, 333, 340, 41, 43, 52, 54, 67, 369, and 371. We've taken a look at the fact that the Grand Mufti's World Muslim Congress, founded immediately after World War II, was a principal link between the World of Islam and the former World Anti-Communist League. The World Muslim Congress was also, and this is very important for the present context, it was also a principal tool of the Western Intelligence Coalition that prosecuted the anti-Soviet Afghan War in the 1980s, and it was that conflict that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden as a warrior and the birth of the Al-Qaeda network. We talked about that, by the way, in For the Record 369, among other programs. The Grand Mufti recruited Balkan Muslims to fight alongside the Nazis, and their successors in modern Bosnia and also Kosovo and the Kosovo Liberation Army, as well as some of the Bosnian Muslim fundamentalists, the successors to some of these Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS units are also linked with the Al-Qaeda milieu. As we looked at in a number of programs, the Grand Mufti was a major influence on the aforementioned Ahmed Huber of the Al-Taqwa Network. The Grand Mufti worked with the Muslim Brotherhood, as we looked at in For the Record 343, among other shows, and he worked with King Ibn Saud, associate of Jack Philby, and Bush business associate and lawyer Alan Dulles. And again, Haj Amin al-Husseini was also the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement and was related to and an inspiration for Yasser Arafat. Now, very important name in one of the Grand Mufti's most important associations was with the key Swiss-born Nazi operative François Genoux. We've spoken about Genoux in many programs, including For the Records 333, 354, 359, 360, and 371. Now, about Genoux. Although he died in 1996, Genoux's name crops up in a number of ways in conjunction with September 11th. One source alleged in an article in the San Francisco Chronicle in March of 2002 that Genoux was actually the founder of Al-Taqwa, which again was alleged to be an Al-Qaeda backer before and after September 11th. We spoke about that in For the Record 352. Ahmed Huber was very close to François Genoux, as we saw in For the Record 343, 54, and 71. And this is very important. In interviews with the financial journal Plus Minus and also with Bavarian State Radio, European money laundering expert Ernest Bacchus alleged that the September 11th money trail would be traced back to corporate fronts set up by François Genoux and apparently still in operation. We looked at that in 354, 357, and 376. Among the many associates of François Genoux was Saeed Ramadan, who was the head, the supreme guide, the mashur of the Muslim Brotherhood, and also, as we looked at in For the Record 343, was the architect of the Brotherhood's redeployment to Germany and then to Switzerland. Genoux, by the way, was a key operative in the networks that aided the post-war flight of Nazi war criminals, including and especially the Odessa Network. François Genoux financed the legal defense of Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, also Adolf Eichmann. We talked about that in For the Record 333 and 352. Now, one of Genoux's protégés and the defense attorney for Klaus Barbie was Jacques Vergès, whose law partner, a woman named Isabelle Coutant-Père, is the French attorney for Zaharias Moussaoui, the accused 20th hijacker. We've looked at that at 341, 344, 354, and 371. Genoux, by the way, was a major backer of the PLO and other Middle Eastern terrorist groups, and Genoux was a principal player in the world of international terrorism. Now, it is in that context that the aforementioned François Genoux's friendship and professional association with a lawyer named Baudouin Dunant assumes very special importance. Now, Baudouin Dunant was an attorney for François Genoux when he stood trial or was brought to justice for his terrorist-related activities in France in 1983. It's very significant because I don't think Genoux would have picked someone who was not sort of in the loop as his attorney under the circumstances. Baudin Dunant was also a close friend of François Genoux. And for our purposes, it's very significant because Baudin Dunant was also the co-chairman of the board of directors of SECO, the Saudi investment company that is the European-based holding company for Saudi bin Laden Group. And Yaslam bin Laden, bin Laden's half-brother, has been the focal point of investigations in Europe in connection with al-Qaeda. Now, in addition, Jeannot attorney and friend Baudin Dunant was involved with moving money for Khalid bin Mahfouz. Khalid bin Mahfouz is married to Osama bin Laden's sister, is implicated in the September 11th scenario, and very, very closely related to the milieu of the BCCI. Now, this brings us to an update, really, a contemporary manifestation would be a way of putting it, of the financial axis that not only helped to spawn fascism in Europe, but also spawned the creation of Saudi Arabia in the wake of World War I. The BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, was a financial institution incorporated in Pakistan originally with branches around the world, very, very closely connected to powerful Saudi oil money. A couple of the key people in connection with the BCCI were the bin Mahfouz family, specifically Khalid bin Mahfouz, and also a guy named Gayit Faron. And when one looks at the BCCI milieu, there are very, very profound connections through that milieu between the corridors of Saudi petroleum money, influential not only because of the oil itself, but because of the tremendous revenues that oil has generated in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia in particular. That money in turn has been reinvested abroad, and the recycled Saudi petrodollars, so to speak, wield a profound political influence in the United States. In particular, the milieu of Khalid bin Mahfouz and Gayit Faron of the BCCI, which went under in 1991 amid investigations for fraud, laundering drug money, terrorist money. It was involved with the Iran-Contra affair. And in fact, John Kerry, who has announced, is apparently going to be running for president on the Democratic ticket, was the head of the subcommittee that uncovered the BCCI investigation. And it was in connection with the Senate's push to get a hold of the client list for Kissinger Associates that Henry Kissinger rebuffed the Senate in 1992. Henry Kissinger just resigned from his position as head of the, quote, independent, unquote, commission that was going to, quote, investigate, unquote, September 11th. BCCI finds the link between Saudi petrodollars and business connections. That milieu, I should say, the milieu of BCCI represents the intersection of recycled Saudi petrodollars and Bush family energy businesses and investments. One of those are Busto Energy. That was the first of George Bush's failed oil companies. One of the people involved with that was James R. Bath, an alleged CIA operative, who also was the Texas business representative for Khalid bin Mahfouz and for Salem bin Laden, bin Laden's older brother. Later, of course, Khalid bin Mahfouz, and also another protege of a BCCI kingpin, Gayit Faron, was basically Harkin Energy once again saw the evolution of the recycled Saudi petrodollars, the milieu of the BCCI, and their business links with the Bush family. Again, in addition to Khalid bin Mahfouz, another of the key BCCI personalities was Gayit Faron. He, in turn, had a protege named Abdullah Baksh, B-A-K-S-H-S. Baksh was the North American business representative for the bin Laden family from 76 to 82. His protege, Talat Otman, became a director of Harkin Energy. And it was Talat Otman who interceded with the now-departed Secretary of the Treasury, Paul O'Neill, on behalf of the Al-Taqwa, Al-Qaeda-connected, Muslim Brotherhood-connected targets of the March 20th Green Quest raids. That's where we began our synopsis. Another of the key links between recycled Saudi petrodollars, including bin Laden family petrodollars, and the Bush family, the Carlyle Group, one of the largest private equity firms. Carlyle has connections to both Bush, both Georges Bush, both senior and junior. And they involved investments by, again, the bin Laden family and also the bin Mahfouz family. Members of the Carlyle Group were in Washington, D.C. for the annual investors conference of the Carlyle Group, along with James Baker, the former Secretary of State under the elder George Bush, and former Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci, and they were at the Investors Conference in Washington, D.C. on September 11th. They watched as the World Trade Centers went down. World Trade Center towers went down, and some of their business prospects went up at the same time. The next day, September 12th, 2001. The only civilians who could fly in the United States were 12 members of the bin Laden family who were flown out of the United States on a private jet chartered by Prince Bandar, then the Saudi ambassador to the United States. Again, on September 12th of 2001, the only civilians who could fly in the United States were 12 members of the bin Laden family. That is more than a little interesting and reflective of the parapolitical power of the recycled petrodollars that we find with the BCCI milieu, Arbusto Energy, and the Carlyle Group. And that was why a guy like Talat Otman could basically tap Paul O'Neill on the shoulder and say, nix. One of the interesting political paths of inquiry is what I have inquired about and what I have nicknamed the Jihad for Freedom. The links between the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization and the aforementioned Grover Norquist suggest that there may have been something of a Muslim equivalent of the Crusade for Freedom, this taking place in the 1980s and 1990s during the closing phase of the Cold War. Now, the Crusade for Freedom was an illegal domestic intelligence operation which Central and Eastern European fascist and Nazi collaborators, many of them war criminals of the First Order, were brought into the United States for domestic anti-Semitic and anti-communist purposes and for the purposes of prosecuting the Cold War. Among the many elements that were brought into the United States was at least one entire SS intelligence unit, the Vorkommando Moscow, settled complete and intact in the New Jersey, New York area to counteract Jewish influence. The fellow who oversaw the Crusade for Freedom, this importation of Nazi war criminals for political purposes and foreign anti-communist purposes, was Alan Dulles, the associate of the Bush family, associate of the Third Reich, and associate of the founders of Saudi Arabia. The fellow who oversaw the CFF for Dulles was Richard Nixon. The fellow who was the spokesperson for the Crusade for Freedom was Ronald Reagan, and the State Department machinations were handled by William Casey. Later, when the elder George Bush was chairman of the Republican National Committee, the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, basically these Central and Eastern European ethnics, fascist veterans, many of them war criminals, were installed as a permanent branch of the Republican Party, literally a Nazi Third Reich branch of the Republican Party operating within the context of that party. The question that I have asked is, are the presence of these Muslim fundamentalists, these Islamo-fascist elements in the Republican Party, courtesy of Grover Norquist and company, are they the residua or the evidentiary faction, or the evidentiary element of a Jihad for Freedom? During the closing stages of the Cold War, were Islamo-fascists brought into the country again to counteract Jewish influence at home and for the successful prosecution of the closing phases of the anti-communist war abroad? Was there a Jihad for Freedom? Another point of inquiry is the long Saudi involvement in domestic politics in a number of programs, including, for the record, 345 and 346. We've looked at the elder George Bush, the petroleum-related faction of the CIA, and the destabilization of Jimmy Carter through the deliberate creation of a, quote, oil shortage. It's interesting, as we gear up for war in Iraq, to remember what Jimmy Carter said about the need for energy conservation. Jimmy Carter called it, quote, the moral equivalent of war, unquote. People laughed at Jimmy Carter. Well, they don't have to worry about moral equivalence anymore. The Saudi involvement in domestic politics is very, very interesting indeed, and the Saudi collaboration with elements of the CIA, the elder George Bush, and the petroleum industry and the destabilization of Jimmy Carter is worth taking note of. Now, the September 11th attacks were ostensibly because of dissatisfaction with not only the U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia, U.S. military presence, by the way, established by the elder George Bush, but also because of continued U.S. support for Israel. What's interesting in connection with the flare-up of hostilities in Israel is to note, first of all, the links between the Republicans and the milieu underlying the PLO. In a number of programs, including For the Record program number 346, we've taken a look at Baker's Dozen. These were some, quote, moderate, unquote, elements of the PLO that were brought into the United States, tutored in public relations by the CIA, and they were proteges of James Baker. They constituted the PLO negotiating team at Camp David. One of the things we've looked at in For the Record 334 and 337 is June 25th of 2000. That's the day that Dick Cheney, an oil man, was named the vice presidential running mate for George Bush, an oil man. That was the day that Yasser Arafat walked out. One of the things we've looked at in program 346, among others, and also a lecture available from Spitfire, L8, was the Republican grooming of the Israeli right. And in numerous programs, including For the Record or Miscellaneous Archive Show M30 and M58, as well as For the Record Program 94 and For the Record Program 246, we've taken a look at the fascist heritage of the right wing of the Likud party in Israel. And another of the talking points is the deliberate grooming of the Israeli right wing. Not Israel, but the Israeli right wing. And the active subversion by the Republican Party of the Clinton administration's Mideast policy vis-a-vis Israel. Bill Clinton vetoed the Dole Amendment, which would have moved the U.S. embassy to Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The then head of Israel, the assassinated late Yitzhak Rabin, was opposed to that, seeing that as inflammatory. Of course, Rabin was assassinated, and Bill Clinton vetoed the Dole Amendment, while Newt Gingrich deliberately courted the Israeli right. And ultimately, the Israeli right went down when Yasser Arafat walked out of the Camp David Peace Accords June 25th, 2000. A couple of the key points I'd love to look at concerns the fact that the PLO has the same kind of a heritage that we've seen with regard to Saudi Arabia and the Third Reich. The PLO's chief funding source is and always has been Saudi Arabia. Yasser Arafat was a protege not only of Haj Amin al-Husseini, he was his successor and his distant cousin. And Otto Skorzeny, again, by the way, was the head of the Odessa and one of Hitler's most cherished operatives. He also, Skorzeny, that is, went to work for the Gehlen Organization. Had Bill Clinton successfully negotiated a peace agreement between Israel and the PLO for a Palestinian state and peace in the Mideast, this almost certainly would have given Al Gore the election in 2000, just as Henry Kissinger interceded with the Vietnamese to help frustrate peace negotiations in 1968, thereby helping to doom Hubert Humphrey's candidacy. One of the questions that I think needs to be asked, both in terms of Baker's Dozen, the PLO's moderate negotiating team at Camp David, and in terms of the Saudi-slash-Third Reich heritage of Yasser Arafat, and in terms of the Republican grooming of the Israeli right wing, and the day that Cheney was in, that was the day that Arafat was out. Did the Republicans deliberately interfere with the Camp David peace process in order to help assure George Bush's victory in 2000? I would also note that when Yasser Arafat walked out, that not only aided George Bush by frustrating Al Gore, it also doomed Ehud Barak to defeat by Ariel Sharon. And with the resumption of hostilities in the fall of 2000, the political polarities are increasing dramatically in the Middle East. My own feeling is that Israel is the ultimate final solution to the Jewish problem. Put them all in one area, surrounded by a hostile population, inflame hostilities, and then provoke an all-out shooting war between the Arabs and the Jews and the Americans to the destruction of all of those. That, I think, is the overall plan here. That obviously is conjectural. Now, there are a number of other points to touch on. I will touch on them only briefly here because of the limitation of time. Granted, this is a very complex series of topics. There will be a long, detailed, annotated synopsis of this synopsis of the massive For the Record inquiry into September 11th and related topics within a week or so of the airing of this program. That'll be in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Now, in terms of understanding what is going on, I believe that just like a B-grade horror movie, say Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, this is neither Pearl Harbor nor the Reichstag fire by itself, but a combination. It is an attack by a hostile foreign power on the United States, the Underground Reich. It also was being used as the excuse for precipitating fascism on the domestic scene. In this regard, it is very much like the Third Reich's attack on France in World War II. It was a hostile attack by a foreign power, but it was welcomed by very powerful elites, in particular economic elite elements within France, that had structural relationships to their ostensible German allies, and who were quite content to see the center-left forces represented by Léon Blum, basically disenfranchised by force of arms, and they basically cashed in a majority stake in their own interests for a large minority stake, and they were carefree. As one Thomas Friedman column recently put it about the Bush administration's attitude toward the war, their attitude is, we're at war, let's party. That was very much like the French. Other points of inquiry, Yaquiism, in terms of the subversion of the United States, its deliberate attack from without and deliberate subversion to the ultimate end of bankruptcy and fascism at home. Bear in mind Yaquiism, a manifestation of fascism that unites left with third world elements and right in an overall fascist ideological union that is primarily anti-American and anti-Semitic. Bear in mind the Third Reich heritage of Iraq, which we now find ourselves pitted against. Bear in mind that the Bush administration, the Third Reich, Saddam Hussein, Iraq, elements of the PLO, the Wahhabi faction in Saudi Arabia, Al-Taqwa, Al-Qaeda, and the Muslim Brotherhood all have a common heritage. That heritage is the Third Reich. Bear in mind the Serpent's Walk scenario. Bear in mind the South African biowarfare connection to, among others, Dr. Larry Ford. Bear in mind the South African connection to the Underground Reich. Was there, in fact, a link between the Bruderbond, the Underground Reich, and the U.S. and perhaps other countries' biowarfare programs, perhaps through Project Coast, the South African BW program? And remember also what we talked about in For the Record 385, the formula, the huge cartel agreement between Standard Oil of New Jersey and IG Farben in 1929, and the utilization of the hydrogenation process to create the Third Reich's oil, and the CDU finance scandal that broke in the early 90s, in which that giant IG Farben-built synthetic fuel plant at Leuna, Germany, the focal point of one of the key air campaigns of World War II, was the focal point of complex maneuvering between powerful industrial interests and powerful political interests. Why Leuna? Is that a formula, as I said, for disaster? Again, I've been synoptic about the concluding points here. Long detailed description not only of 391 but other For the Record programs in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. There for free. There are also descriptions of lectures and archive shows that can be purchased for a nominal price from Spitfire. I don't get money from that. And a big tip of the hat to sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, for archiving the For the Record programs for free on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older For the Record programs for download only on Real Audio. All of it for free, the whole For the Record series available online for free, thanks to WFMU. More recent programs, again, streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. That website is also linked to the longer URL for download only and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. People can peruse the description of 391 at spitfirelist.com, but that concludes the broadcast itself. This has been For the Record 391 Discussion Points for September 11th and related topics. This is being recorded on December 15th of 2002, and with a head cold, this is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.